Hello, it's Kathy Love here. I'm a business coach who helps allied health professionals run powerful and profitable businesses in the disability sector. So no big surprise, I talk a lot. And now I can share some of the incredible people that cross my path and the interesting conversations that we have. Private Practice Secrets podcast is all about sharing our business experiences and harnessing our collective wisdom. My guests are amazing. They're bold, brave, and they're honest. There are many laughs, and surprisingly, there's frequent talk of wine. We're sure you're really going to enjoy these unplugged private practice chats. So settle in. Let's get the conversation started. Welcome, Bevsha. I think we have every piece of technology turned off and plugged in. Everything except the coffee maker to make this conversation happen. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. How are you?
I'm well. I've had a really good day and I've been looking forward to this. So this is, I think, take three with our competitive diaries. This has been about take three. So we need to talk really quick in case the technology fails or we have to reschedule. So take us back. You trained in South Africa and the training you did was different to what typically happens in Australia, isn't it? Because you come up as a speech pathologist with a double degree, yeah?
Okay, well, I've actually got a triple degree.
Oh, triple degree. Silly me.
Far more impressive than it actually is. What it is the qualification at the time at Wits University, which was one of South Africa's best universities, was that you couldn't just study speech pathology. It was a joint double degree, whereby you qualified with a speech pathology as well as an audiology degree. So when I came to Australia, the requirements to practice as an audiologist were different, and I chose not to go down that route. The other qualification that I have is my mother, in her wisdom, sent me to speech and drama lessons for most of my schooling, and I continued with it right through my uni days. And I decided it was something I wanted to see right through to the end. So I actually got an associate as well as a licentiate diploma through Trinity College of London in speech and drama. And I'm so grateful that I did because I use the two intertwined all the time.
I did know about your drama qualification and it is a huge point of difference. So, and knowing you and the incredible work that you deliver to your clients, I concur that it's, yeah, had a huge part in your service development. Bevsha, speech pathology.
You can Bevsha. Go with Bev for the conversation.
When did that start?
So my own practice started in the year 2000. Prior to that, when I first arrived in Australia, I worked for the Department of Education and I also worked part-time in a private practice. I then switched over to working full-time in somebody else's private practice before opening my own.
That's right. I remember that now because we met in the mid to late 90s when you'd first come out.
98. Yep. I arrived in Australia in 98 and I had contacted somebody prior to arriving to see what the job opportunities were like and was told that I would never get a job, that I was a new grad, and unless I was an expert in the field of autism, I had no chance of employment. So that was an exciting thing to arrive.
Considering
my husband had no job either set up or planned, and it really, really wasn't the case. What I found out years later was the person I had run, I had actually not calculated the time difference very well and had woken her up in the middle of the night. I think that's why I got the response that I got. But it literally took me less than a month, I think, to get a position. And from there, the rest was up to lucky breaks and just grabbing opportunities as they arose.
Are you able to share up those lucky breaks and opportunities?
Sure. When I arrived, I contacted the person whose number I'd been given, and it just turned out she had laryngitis at the time and was supposed to be participating in a multidisciplinary team conference. And that conference involved assessing four children with Fragile X syndrome. So I was told, you know, it's a voluntary position, there's no payment whatsoever. And I grabbed it because I thought every minute of experience that I could get is a minute more than I had. So I grabbed it, and purely from there, not only did she later on employ me, but the actual medical clinical director employed me initially on an administrative level, and later, when I started my practice, to see his own son. So that was definitely one of them where I didn't shy away from a new opportunity. and I took it from there.
And that's where our paths crossed. And fair to say, we caught the Fragile X bug back in 98. And it's been something, it's been an area that we've both worked in. You're still a lot more engaged than I am. How about, well, let's take a little soapbox moment and talk a tiny bit about Fragile X, but more importantly, how your speech pathology and your private practice has really travelled alongside that Fragile X journey as well.
Okay, so I've worked in different capacities with the Fragile X Clinic, which is based in Melbourne and is currently the only clinic of its type in Australia. And within that clinic, I was the clinic coordinator, which gave me an awesome opportunity to be a team manager, manage a multidisciplinary team, and learn so much from the occupational therapists and the psychologists and the doctors that I worked with, as well as genetic counsellors, optometrists, and audiologists. Then I, at times, took on the role of the speech pathologist, and I assessed clients directly. All this time, though, I was seeing some private clients with Fragile X syndrome, as well as attending, I've now attended three of the international Fragile X conferences in America, where I've had the opportunity to present, as well as upskill myself in the area in order to consult with other speech pathologists. It's also taken me around the country in terms of presenting at a lot of workshops and clinics, taken me internationally as well. So I've presented in New Zealand and, as I said, at the actual conferences in America as well.
From my experience, it's the most incredible community to be involved in. The people I've met have just been extraordinary. And you're still engaged and still working in that space?
Absolutely. I am just currently seeing clients for some of the clinics, along with Felicia Schmarman, who's the other speech pathologist. We work, you know, as a consultant in the Fragile X clinic. And a part of my caseload at the moment is Fragile X clients. I have expanded that some of my team members are now seeing Fragile X clients under my guidance, but they've also accompanied me to America and upskilled themselves as well in this field.
Absolutely. It's amazing. And I suspect you've got very exciting Fragile X related plans ahead as well. You've mentioned your team. Whilst I really want to know who's in the team at the moment, how about we just go back a little bit? And you've worked as a contractor and a clinician in other private practices, and your own private practice has just grown and grown and grown. What did you learn about working in a private practice?
So initially when I started the way most people start, in the spare room in my unit, and it all just took off far quicker than I could ever have imagined. I was really nervous. Initially, I thought everybody else knew more than me, could do more than me. I felt I never had enough experience possibly in the country. And I thought I'd started off really, really slowly. But it snowballed faster than I could ever have imagined. And within a year, I was already employing contractors to come and work for me because of the caseload. It just was bigger than I could manage at that stage. And that was working 5 full days. So it wasn't until several years later, when I had my first child, I took a little bit of a back step, but I laugh to this day that I remember being in the labour ward on my phone taking a call.
That
might have been my second child, that I think about it. That might have been with my second child, yeah. And you know what? I prided myself in that. I really did. That it was it just foreshadowed what was to come. This idea of, yes, motherhood was ahead of me, but I would never stop working. It just wasn't within my nature. It wasn't within my character. And I knew it would be going forward from there. One, in a way, unfortunate event that happened is that one of my schools I was contracting to changed their policy, and they wouldn't have any additional members from my practice working on campus. They only wanted the sole practitioner or the practice principal to see clients. So whereas I had all these wonderful plans put in place for people to see my clients, I was also forced back into the workforce a lot quicker than I'd expected because that was my main school at the time.
What did you know about business management back then?
Well, probably extremely little, but I grew up with a father who had a business background, plus a brother who was studying commerce at the time as well. And I've always seen myself as being very entrepreneurial. whether it was selling my paintings when I was 5 years old for a couple of cents each. I used to display them in an art gallery and people would have to come and buy them. I remember when I was about 14 making some beautiful quilted craft books, some exercise books, and I set up a little business that way. So I really always liked the idea of having the creative side of my practice, having the business side, having the academic side, and really merging all of them. So I think it was always in my blood, but in terms of how to run a business, how to set one up, absolutely nothing. It came from experience. I remember for years, my husband and I on Sunday nights would process the credit cards together, sometimes way after midnight once we got the children to sleep, from my home office at the time. I never had, you know, a practice manager or an admin assistant in those days. But what I was always very, very conscious of, thanks to my father, was making sure everything was 300% above board and legal. So I had a legal advisor right from the start and an accountant to make sure that even though I was doing this on my own and learning the ropes, that legally everything was up and running. And I've always been grateful for that. Whenever I've had a bookkeeper come and work for me, they've always said, wow, it's amazing how clean these books are compared to a lot of the other sides. And it is something I pride myself on.
Your dad, I don't know if you remember, he was my first business mentor too.
I do remember that. And he actually started working with me at one time and I got him to follow up on my debtors, et cetera. But he was such a fastidious worker and so eager, I think, to sort of get all the books under wraps and not have any debtors whatsoever that absolutely. I think he took it a bit far at heart. I'll never forget one of the special education coordinators ringing me and really phoning with a complaint against my person who was doing my debt collection. And before I could actually stop her, because she was so angry, to tell her it was actually my father, she said, and what he even did is told me this is an outstanding invoice when in fact I only received it that morning. So it was just too hard working with him. I loved him to bits. But when he got his teeth into something, he was a bulldog. And it just didn't mesh with my approach to clients, being personable, having amazing relationships. He saw it purely on the business side. And after a couple of months, I thanked him for his service, but was more than happy to see the back of it.
Yep, I remember the attention to detail and the fastidiousness around policies and procedures. And he threw the light on so many parts of my business that I hadn't even registered as being problematic. You know, you just don't know what you don't know. So, yeah, that was a good kickstart for me too.
Where I always did still use him as a sounding board, though, was in terms of any new ventures I was looking at or any possible sidelines that I may have considered. I always use them as a sounding board, but I like to pride myself on that my decisions were my own, or mine and my husband's, and that I was purely using him as an advisor and not that I had to follow his advice.
Yeah.
In fact, at one point when I left, it wasn't really a partnership, but when I was working for somebody, I was given legal advice at the time. And, you know, I was young, I knew very little, and I actually chose to go against that legal advice. And I believe it was the best thing I could ever have done, because I still have a great relationship with that person today. We managed to come up with an amicable agreement and still be able to really value one another and see each other as professionals.
Preserve that working relationship.
Yeah, and not burn the bridges through definitely going the hard, you know, litigation or legal route, or following the advice that I was given at the time.
Yep, I think I've got a visual on that situation. So, yes, yep, you invest very heavily in your professional relationships, Bev. I hope you don't mind me saying that. And you work hard at them and you preserve them. You've got an amazing network across town and you're very much loved.
Mm. Very, very lucky to have the connections that I have. But I think they always need to remain mutually beneficial networks and arrangements.
Yep.
And I think if they weren't, I wouldn't still have them today. So it's that feeling of being generous. I think being generous and giving value to get value, the more I think of that, the more I just keep coming back to that idea and that we can count on one another, rely on one another without it necessarily, you know, coming along with a price tag each time.
Yeah. Your practice is currently literally around the corner from my office and I drive past it all the time. Walk us through. So from the curb, what's behind the door?
Okay. So from the curb, we've got some signage, first of all, on the windows. And the signage shows that I actually co-locate in those premises. So I share my premises with Bev Kadish, who's an occupational therapist from Right Start Occupational Therapy. And we're very, very close friends as well. And because that friendship was important to us, we've never merged our businesses. We've always kept them completely separate. But both of us were looking for some premises at the same time, which was about 4 or 5 years ago. And the opportunity came up for us to co-locate, to share expenses, and to share some of our admin staff costs as well. So that's where we're based. And the signage itself, it's probably the one thing that I hate most about the practice.
I was wondering if you were going to say that.
You
were never happy from the start, were you?
I'm embarrassed that I still haven't changed it, but because the actual structuring of my practice may be changing, I've just let it lie for now. Just not what I wanted. It was clear, the colours weren't bold enough, but it served its purpose. So that's, you know, watch the space.
Okay, we'll move on. We won't dwell on that.
Inside our practice, we have these bright, bright yellow walls. And that's the first thing that struck me. And because my name's Bev and obviously my colleague Bev as well, I wanted to call it the Beehive. I thought that would be a brilliant name and, you know, have a tag name, a hive of activity. The fact that we offer speech services,
yes,
and OT services, etc. But no one else was overly keen for that.
I love it. You didn't ask me. I think it's great.
I know. I should have. Obviously, you weren't part of my market research cluster of people. Yeah, that I did it on. So as you walk in, we have our first therapy area. And what I love about our rooms is that they're all suitable for both adult and pediatric clients. Although we tend to see a lot more pediatric, we do see a lot of adolescents and young adults. And I think because they're at such a difficult and vulnerable stage of their lives, the last thing they want to come into is an infantile, childish-looking environment. And I was very, very cautious of making sure that different rooms could be adapted accordingly. So in all of our rooms, we've actually got adjustable tables as well as 4 chairs, 2 adult-sized chairs and 2 children's chairs. And that works really well because the client you might have just seen might have been an 18-year-old, but within 2 minutes, you can adjust the room, you know, to 2 to 3 year old as well. So there's the first of our 4 therapy areas. We've got a beautiful waiting room with some beautiful artwork. So the artwork in there was originally, the first piece is a huge colourful butterfly, and that was chosen by Bev Kadish. And I managed to source a pony that's done in very much a similar style with oils as well to match. So the two marry really well. We have our reception area, lots of toys in the waiting room, lots of magazines, and a variety of some construction toys, some, you know, different choices for different kids' interests. We've got a long corridor with huge, huge skylights, which just on a sunny day, there's nothing better than walking into the room because it literally is light-filled and hope-filled with it. On a gloomy day, we turn the lights on and we sort of get that same effect. They have a sensory gym, which she works in, and when it's not being used, I've got access to that too. So if I have a, you know, client who's extremely hyper-aroused, I love the fact that I can go straight in, grab any of the OT equipment that I need. Even if the gym's being occupied, I'll bring a big football into my room and do some compression or some bouncing on it with the client. So that's been really cool. And what it also does is it doubles our resources in terms of our more general therapy-based games and literacy resources. So we're basically in each other's cupboards all the time. I then have my main consulting room, which is a large room with lots of free space for floor work as well as desktop work. And the back room is where most of my books and worksheet-based resources are kept. But again, it does have a therapy table there, should we need to use that room as well. We've got a little kitchen at the back. We've got our bathroom, which we all share. And that leads us out onto the back car park, where we've got space for lots of the therapists to park as well.
Mm. Who makes up your team at the moment, Bev?
So my team is in a state of changing because up until a couple of months ago, I was running or involved in two different practices. So that's actually downscaled, as many of the therapists on that team have continued with the partnership that I was in. Whereas now I have one main therapist, Liz Zanitsky, and I see her very much as my right-hand person. We work in a very similar way and we work with similar types of clients. So Liz is my most full-time therapist. I also have a new grad, Miriam Perez, who I've taken on board, and that's working out fantastically as well. Additionally, I have Margot Pogos, who is a very part-time therapist and just comes in and sees clients when needed. Lovely. So that's the therapist at the moment. We have administration staff. We have a main practice manager at the moment and a bookkeeper.
Good. Are you using HealthKit or Clinica? You're using some software.
We're in the process of changing onto practice management software.
Okay.
The two we're looking at is My Practice or Clinica, but we haven't implemented any of that yet.
Okay.
Well, I've sort of waited till the very last minute, but realised that it gets to a point where my fears have to be subsided and we've just got to go forward and get everything digitalised, cloud-based, you know. Really scary for someone who works very much still in the old-fashioned pen and paper type model when working with kids, but I've realised it is the way things are moving and it is the way I need to move.
It certainly is going to help scale and growth if you've got it all digital and centralised and all your content, your clinical content and billing content in one place. Sort of been my experience. So I'll come and hold your hand. I'll arrive with a packet of lolly snakes and hold your hand. We can do that.
Awesome. And now that I know that it is happening and it's not just something, you know, to consider, I'm actually excited. I'm excited to embrace it and use it to its fullest capability.
Yeah, you know, it's good stuff. In regards to your business, what are you most proud of?
Probably the fact that I've never marketed.
Ooh. The extent,
I'm not saying that moving forward and in today's market, I don't need to market. I certainly do. And that's why for the first time 3 weekends ago, I did a Facebook video after watching one of your podcasts, which we can talk about afterwards as well. So that was an interesting experience. But whilst building up my practice, I was always inundated with more referrals than I could actually manage. And I know it sounds amazing and sounds like everyone's dream, but it wasn't. It wasn't because I didn't always have the right structure in place to deal with it. Mm. So it actually brought with it a lot of negative stress instead of the positive stresses that should have outweighed the negative ones. Things like just not having sufficient staff, not having the right staff. I've never wanted staff to see a client purely on availability. So I think what I'm really proud of is, I'm going to come back to that word relationship, whether it be the relationships that I have with the staff members, where they know that I would much rather they pick up the phone and ring me and ask me something than do it on their own. I make myself extremely available, probably too available, but I don't care. I have that set up with my husband and my family that when my staff need me, I am available to them. And very much for the relationships with the schools I've worked in and with the parents themselves. So that word of mouth has just been main referral source. And I'm seeing exactly the same thing with Liz now, whereby, you know, more so she's just bringing in and creating her own referral, and those are just creating more from me. So the fact that I've never had to hard sell the practice up until now, I realise now that the whole face of private practice is changing and that everybody does need to promote their services. I think I used to view it more as a, I'm not a salesperson, I'm a professional. But without fully letting people know and servicing the community, by letting them know what you're actually offering, you're actually serving them a disservice. And I've really got my head around that one now after doing some courses that have helped me through that.
Yeah, we've both been in private practice almost the same amount of time in a way, and I've certainly noticed lots of changes. What are the current challenges at the moment as you see it for private practitioners?
I think the sheer amount of choice that people have got. In the past, I think there was this, that you had to be a therapist of a certain level and almost have a reputation in order to go into private practice, where that's not the case now. Because I see myself, therapists with not many years behind them, going in and jumping in, deciding to open multidisciplinary clinics, And I think each clinic has to prove itself. I say is the word that I think I'm looking for. But because there is so much more choice now out there, people make their choices based on different things. Some may make it based on the clinic that looks the most impressive or has the glossiest brochure. And unless you're in there and, you know, competing with them, yeah, I don't believe you're going to stand a chance. I don't think we can just lay back and say, oh, I've got a great name. I've got so many referral sources. I'm going to sit back and relax now. If you're looking forward to not only maintain, but to grow a practice as well. Does that make sense?
Spot on. I agree. I'm doing a high five. Not that that's particularly useful for a podcast, but doing a high five.
I felt it.
You got it. You got it. Felt the love. What makes your business unique?
Okay. So at this stage, the fact that we work a lot in the disability sector as well as in mainstream. So we have such a mixed caseload with a real passion and interest in ASD and mainly in the area of social skills. And when I say we, I'm saying myself and Liz. So that's what we really want to use as our point of difference and move forward with offering services in the line of social skills, but not just with children, the fact that we work with adults as well, and the fact that we don't just work in either mainstream or disability, but we cover the whole range. So I think that's a very unique angle to be coming from and would possibly make me different to some others. I think the fact that I have worked so closely and continue to do so every day with allied health professionals and in multidisciplinary teams. I can sit down at a PSG and often make suggestions that I've learned, whether it be from a psych I've worked with or OTs that I've worked closely with. But I feel confident enough to make them because of the number of years that I've been involved and that I've seen these things actually help and be really useful. So I've been really lucky to have the frustrated OT in me be able to come out of time. In hindsight, I think I regret not looking more into OT before I did speech. Probably, I don't think I haven't considered a master's in OT. I certainly looked into that, but not just quite for this stage of my life yet.
We'll appoint you an honorary OT.
Thank you. And honestly, I believe at times I can certainly hold my own on a very limited amount of topics.
Yeah,
I wouldn't go so far as to say on several areas.
Yeah. No, you're a good OT. You're a great OT. For a speech pathologist, you're a really good OT, Bev.
Thank you. And from coming from you, well, I'll take that as a huge compliment. Thank you. And without driving the point home again, what makes us different, I believe, again, is not just seeing it as apples, you know, or dollar signs, as it's purely run as a business, but the relationships that we have with the people and the people who want to stay with us because we've established those relationships.
Mm.
For example, intakes. I've always done the intakes. As much as I would love to outsource all of that to, you know, a clinical director or a practice manager, and I'm not saying that may not be the case in the future, but up until now, and it's very time-consuming and it's unpaid time, but I love the fact that I really get a good feel for the client. I develop a relationship right from the start, even if I'm not going to land up working with that client, with that parent. I get their background, I match them with the best therapist for them, not just the therapist that's available, or I refer them on to someone else who I think would be more suitable. And that's why when it comes to meeting with my staff, they often say to me, how do you know what's going on with this client? How have you got a grip? To me, that's always been very important as well. If it's under my practice and under my letterhead, I need to be able to bump into any parent on that caseload and at least have a somewhat current knowledge of where their child is at. I'm not saying that I can follow up on every goal in every session. That's just not feasible. But I do know if there's been a major change with that child, if that child's doing particularly well, I like to try and be as up to date as possible with the changes with each child.
And we both live and work in the same communities, and I see my clients around the shops and at schools and places all the time. So to have that working knowledge is very relevant because there's a really good chance you'll be bumping into your clients all over the place. That's been my experience.
Absolutely. In fact, on Friday, I haven't returned a phone call that I was supposed to, And as I passed the butcher, I saw that mum there. But I very quickly did a sweet 180 and made sure I
went.
Oh, yes. I immediately to apologise that I hadn't returned the call.
Yeah, yeah. And that's life. That's life. That's out of the honesty and the relationship management. This time next year, we're going to have the NDIS knocking on our door. What do you think you'll be telling me about that in a year's time?
So I've really tried to do some preparation without getting too deep into the preparation. And the reason I'm saying that is the advice that I was given was so much will be changing.
Mm.
So rather than trying to get my head around the very first NDIS registration, which really in hindsight would have been a waste of time because of how much has changed, I've decided to go slower with it and do each step as that step is suggested or recommended. So up until now, I've done my own self-study on NDIS. I've spoken with parents, I've spoken with professionals, I've attended a couple of talks, I've done some webinars, joined in, not produced them. But I'm taking sort of a watch and wait approach because I feel there might still be significant changes. I'm cautious that I don't want my whole practice to become an NDIS practice.
Mm.
I read somewhere the idea of having more than one stream of income, especially in light of the difficulties with the portal and the payments and things like that, I think is important. Plus, in terms of a reputation, I don't want my practice to purely be seen or become an NDIS specialised practice. Do we want to offer those services that we currently are and that we feel we're good at? Absolutely. Plus the Fragile X work, I think, would be a big point of difference in where my main involvement almost, along with my Down syndrome clients and my ALSD clients, you know, I'll definitely be involved in it. However, I want to keep as much of a balance as possible, especially with some of the other therapists who may not be working with as many NDIS clients, so that it's not an all or nothing. I think it's important to keep the balance.
Yeah, I agree. And after last year's portal debacle, I think that was a bit of a wake-up call for many who were already engaged with NDIS, but also a bit of an amber light against those who were watching and waiting and wondering about how deep they would get in it as well. So,
I mean, as much as I'd love to only take on self-managed clients, I've never seen myself as a therapist who only does things to suit myself. And I think that we would be only looking after my best interests. Plus the fact that we do know in Fragile X, there's a lot of mums who just wouldn't have the ability to properly self-manage. My intentions at this stage are not to, you know, I sometimes call it sit in an ivory tower, whereby some clinicians say, no, we don't do school visits, we don't attend PSGs, we don't see clients, you know, at school. As amazing as that is, and, you know, I think it would make my life far less hectic and less stressful, but I think it is out on a lot of the benefits to the clients themselves. And I see that as the NDIS as well. I think there could be so many clients who could benefit from my services who are not self-managed. It's just a matter of me setting up the right system so that things can flow.
Yeah. And you've got some time to kind of think about the way you want those services to look as well. And the funds might bring some creativity out as well in terms of what you can build around the kids and what they need and where stuff's going to happen and mixing it up, because you're very much a community provider as well as a clinic provider. And whilst there's a bit of a trend for clinic-based services because of the difficulties and the costs around travel, I think that is going to change in the next 12 months, and what you're planning for your clients, you know, from the start of next year could be a little bit different from what they've been thinking they could have.
Absolutely. And the other avenues we're looking at is not just offering pure speech pathology services, but services that have a connection with speech pathology and can be headed by speech pathologists, but to just broaden up the lifestyle of so many of our clients.
Oh, that sounds divine. That sounds amazing.
I can't go into too much detail. It's all very
I know you can't. I know. Secret
so
sauce.
So exciting.
I have to get you
and
back
later. Once it's all up and running, and it will be up and running. But, you know, that idea of being creative and,
innovative.
And just thinking outside the box a little bit. I'll just give you one snapshot of something we offered the other night. I've engaged with some young, call them students in the community, not allied health related, but students who've done some work with individuals in the past with additional needs. And the other night what we did is we arranged for both Liz and I, for each of us had a client come in, and we set up a dinner and games night with these three neurotypical students to come in as social surrogates.
Oh, great.
Social supporters, social mentors. And the idea now is that each one of them will be mentored by us with regards to the individual client, but that they will go and set up their own arrangements now so that whatever work we've been working on can happen in so many different environments.
And spontaneously,
and just exposure in a naturalistic context, real time, real life, and these guys were just—they were all just phenomenal and so keen for us to expand now into the next area that we want to do by offering services like that.
That is very, very cool and very, very. What's the word? Potentially huge interest for people with that are approaching their NDIS planning process to be able to purchase real lifestyle options and programs that have really concrete and obvious outcomes rather than sitting down with a face-to-face one-on-one therapy. I'm doing therapy, you know, therapy in air quotes, you know what I mean? It's just such, the NDIS is just such a good driver for us rethinking the way we do things. Same old just isn't going to work going forward.
Plus the fact that, you know, the whole idea of the reciprocal relationship, that socialization has to involve two parties. You cannot be social on your own. So as much as it was for the client's benefit, just this idea of building up tolerance, of building up acceptance, and of it was just a mutual enjoyment of each other's company. We all walked out of there on such a high, and we just want to be able to offer that on a much larger scale.
Wonderful. Look forward to hearing more about that. You're the most divine and skilled presenter. Are you doing any teaching or workshops?
I love that side, and again, next year I think some of my speaking grammar comes into it.
Just a little bit. Just hard to notice, but it's there.
One part of my presenting, though, that I think is different perhaps to some others, is I really do put an emphasis on the practical side, on the participants being able to walk out with, as Dr. Phil says, some verbs in their hand. You know, what am I actually going to do with this information that I've got? So initially when I started presenting, I felt so intimidated because I didn't feel up there academically. And, you know, even now when I'm on Facebook groups, I see some colleagues' responses and I think, I'm so intimidated by that. But at the end of the day, I think, okay, but what could I possibly offer that they couldn't? And this is where my presentations, I share my own experiences. I share things that have, you know, worked for me as a parent as well as, you know, their parent perspective. And we can chat a bit about that as well. But I make sure they're all extremely hands-on and that things like statistics and research. I'm not saying that what I'm saying isn't evidence-based, but that just doesn't become the emphasis of my presentation. I present with so many different topics, which is exciting as well, and to different audiences. So I haven't done as much this year as I did last year, possibly because of all the changes that are happening. But, yeah, I will be presenting at the Social Needs Conference, being held at the NDG again this year, and I'm looking forward to that.
I'm going to just drop that gentle challenge in there that it is such a talent that you have, that for you to get a little bit of a calendar happening and some events, and ordinarily I would have said put that on your website, but I know that your website's under construction, so
still. Constant construction.
Just saying, still.
The little hamster wheel's going round and round, and will continue to.
Yeah.
So, you know, whether it be parent talks, I've been in school, done PD days for whole school, which I love as well, because it's got to be a topic and it's got to be material that so many people can relate to. So, for example, this little video that I put on a few weeks ago, I didn't realise how far reaching, you know, the results would be, and that people have come up to me with three-year-olds and people have come up to me with students, you know, who are in VCE, and they have found it equally, you know, as relevant. I think sometimes going broader with more general sort of tips and advice versus always going very, very specific, it's some good advice as well.
Yep, absolutely. And the most powerful thing, if you like, about presenting is people get to hear you and they get to see you and they get to soak up your values and the language you use and the respect you have for your clients and the services you provide. And it really is such an effective way of building trust and respect and word of mouthness. And it sits so beautifully with the value you put on relationships and word of mouth and that approach to your marketing. So I see that as that makes complete
sense. And the you know, the enthusiasm, because I get very enthusiastic.
You do, actually. Yeah, you've reminded me now that I think about it.
Yeah. And that's what I think filters through, that I have that enthusiasm. You know, I think the word passion is used. You know, she's got a passion for this. I think it's thrown away too easily, thrown around too easily today. But just the enthusiasm that anything can be achieved, just that idea of growth mindset, I think it is that opportunity, as you say, which is very different to a pamphlet or a brochure or a website even.
Yep, absolutely. All of my guests have the chance to ask me a question. Is that something you've thought about and something that you want to throw back to me?
Well, I'm going to go, because we haven't actually discussed my family at all, and I'm going to start off with the segment and to move on to the question. And my statement is that many, many years ago, I remember you saying to me that you were a better part-time mother, meaning a mother working part-time, than you would have been if you were a full-time parent. And those words have stayed with me, and at times when I've needed some reassurance that I'm doing an okay job on the parenting side, I've often thought about that. Now that your kids are older, do you look back and would you have done anything different in terms of the work-life juggle?
Such a rock star of a question, Bev, sure. I always tried to do my very best at the time, and I always tried to be as present as possible in the room, in the physical geographical room that I was in. So if I was in my office at work, I was 200% in my office at work. And if I was at home in the kitchen, I really, really, really tried to be in the kitchen and, you know, dealing and enjoying whatever, you know, whirlwind was going on around me. And when my kids were, when our son and daughter were growing up, there was barely mobile phones. I had a brick, you know. There was no internet to speak of. There was no social media to speak of. So in some ways, that was made easier, that there was no need to check anything because there was nothing to check.
All the time.
Yeah. I probably worked too hard. Our son and daughter, now that they're older and engaging in their professional lives, have on a recent family holiday have sort of said that they now understand a little bit more about my work ethic than they did when they were primary schoolers and teens. They understand now about a little bit more about the stress I was under at different times. They also understand a little bit more about the passion piece that I bring to pretty much everything I do. I'm a bit of a all or nothing girl. And they're starting to see that from an adult perspective as well. So whilst I'm not asking forgiveness from our son and daughter, it's interesting to see what they have picked up and noted as young adults. I am pretty sure I worked too hard. I'm pretty sure I missed just one or two many school events, but that's how it was. And the energy I put in gave us the lifestyle that we had. It gave us all sorts of knowledge that we may not have had otherwise, access to all sorts of toys and IT and stuff later on. And it, you know, gave a pretty clear message that working mums are pretty invincible and pretty tough and can really change things up for all sorts of people. I suspect it also gave them one perspective on social justice and social values, which they are both now commenting on. At the same time, though, I just wished that I wasn't always so exhausted and so tired. So more self-care I might have invested in. But like I said, I did the best I could. Perhaps wasn't always good
enough. Knowing your kids.
Bev, what are your thoughts on the parenting business owner plate spinning scenario?
Okay, I think it's definitely become easier as my children are a bit older. They're now 8 and 13, but when they were very young, especially when they were unwell, it was just the hardest thing in the world for me, because people would always say to me, your children come first, but I put so much value in my clients as well and in their continuity and their well-being that it wasn't as simple as purely saying my children come first. Again, what I did learn though is that because my clients were mothers as well, they really, really did understand, and they realised that I was there to try and make it up to them in any way that I could, whether it be rescheduling, whether it be a makeup session. I always did my very, very best to do that. But I think it's made my children into the resilient children that they are today, because they haven't had me as being the first mum to collect them at creation at school and at every school event and behind the, you know, the line of touch of mummies and things like that. And I often joke about it that, you know, every time I am the last one at pick up day to get my son, they said, no, it's resilience building. But in essence, I truly, truly believe it has been, because he knows that the reason why, as you say, he gets a lot of things in his life are because of the amount of time and effort that I have to spend working, but that when I am with him, I am so in the moment. And it really does come down to that quality versus the quantity. I know and am confident that I can do a far better job in those gifts and opportunities than I could do if I was with them all the time and didn't have, you know, those special moments to share with them. What's made it so much easier, though, is my husband, in that he has always had the same value in my work and understands my work ethic. And because of that, we've managed to adapt really, really well. I think it's given him amazing time to be with the kids, where other fathers may have been busy doing other things. And it's just a given. A lot of things have always just been a given, that if mum's on a call, mum's on a call, because mm-hmm. it's a work call. And if it wasn't a work call, they know I would have forced the call or gone to attend to them. And they know if I'm in my office working, it's not a matter of putting a guilt trip on me, but mum, it's just been the way from the time they were born that I've instilled this message into them as to, obviously, they are the most important things in my life, but my work is also extremely important to me, and that I make a difference in a lot of other people's lives. It comes back to the social justice that I think you were speaking about.
Mm.
My older son is incredibly proud that his mum has her own business. And even in something at school, he had to write about his aspirations. It was, you know, for him to own his own business like his mum and dad did. And mum actually owned her own business before dad did. So he always saw this as the coolest, coolest thing. And I think it's really given him a message that you work hard and you can get results.
Mm. So well said.
Now that they're, you know, now that they're older and certainly more self-sufficient, but I really do try and let them know whenever it is. I think it comes down to gratitude as well. So I'll make a point of letting them know that I may not be able to be with them at this particular event, but what I will do is I'm putting aside time in another day in order to be with them. So that is all very explicitly explained to them, and we've tried to nurture this attitude of gratitude for when I am with them, when I give them things and I do things with them, that it's not just taken as a given, that, you know, that's what I should be doing.
Oh, such beautiful words.
Pearls of wisdom.
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. So I'm mindful of time and it's getting late. I know we could talk all afternoon here. I am going to give you the last word. So think about a couple of tips or a couple of gems that you would like to share with listeners about building your business, hanging in there mentally, juggling family. You can pick your gems. And then if you give a shout out to the name of your business and where people can find you, I'm just very happy to hand the talking stick over and let you bring it on home.
Well, on a practical level, again, because I like to practice what I preach, and I said it's all about being practical, two areas of PD that I've done recently that I would highly, highly recommend. The one is becoming more familiar with the idea of social thinking. And even for those that don't run social groups or work a lot in that area, the implications that it has for people's learning, for their relationship building, and for their academic progress, I think is amazing. So you can check that out, Michelle Garcia Winner, socialthinking.com. The other course I did last year was the Feuerstein Instrumental Enrichment course, which is a cognitive thinking program. I had many, many years ago done an introductory program, and I went and redid the full basic course last year. And I just find myself using these ideas and this terminology, this idea of embracing challenges and making mistakes and celebrating mistakes in all my sessions, in my groups, in my conversations with parents and in PSGs, you know, as well, so often. Another tip I'd say is perseverance. So when you've got a really challenging client and it seems like it's just not making a big difference, maybe change your goals rather than saying to the parents, I've done as much as I can. I've always been very honest with the parents, saying if I don't feel I'm making much difference or if I feel there's a better person, but I've never, ever, ever given up on a client or taken the easy way of saying, you know what, I'm not really enjoying this time, it's hard work, I'm not getting much out of them. Never giving up, I think, is so, so important. And finally, just that word relationship. Have amazing relationships with your clients because it will make them want to not only refer you on, but stay with you as well.
Thank you.
Very, very honored to have an amazing relationship with you, Catherine. So just a big thank you to you for all your guidance, your expertise, and the friendship that we've shared for many years.
My pleasure. Back at you. Well, thank you. So much good stuff in there. I'm going to let you disappear off into your afternoon and spread your awesomeness around, and we will be in touch soon. Well, thanks, Bev Sher.
I'm off to that very school pickup that I spoke about. So, and what I've done is put in place a backup plan that if I'm not there in time, I've got an amazing circle of friends who can pick up my son for me just to give me those extra 10 or 15 minutes so that I can drive at the speed limit and get there in one piece to pick him up. So, yeah, yes. It's all about contingency plans. Gotta have them.
Gotta have them. Alrighty, have a great afternoon. Thanks, Bev.
Thank you, Kathy. Bye-bye.
Bye. A big thank you for investing your time right through the end of this episode of Private Practice Secrets. We hope you really enjoyed the conversation. There's lots more just like it waiting for your listening ears. If you're running a private practice and keen for some more business know-how and confidence, head on over to my website, nakerconsulting.com.au. There you'll find business resources and inspiration. There's blogs, forms, templates. There's information about our conferences, workshops, web events, and more. While you're there, you're warmly invited to book yourself in for a free 30-minute coaching session. Let's find some solutions to your current business challenges. And yes, you are more than welcome to pick my brains. My business has a weird name, but it has a cool story. You can read about that when you're on the website. But let me spell it for you now. nacre.com.au. Thank you for listening to Private Practice Secrets. I'm Kathy Love, Allied Health Business Coach, wishing you and your business a brilliant day.